So, as you recall, we left off on Thursday talking about the issues of authentication. What is authentication again? But the question of proving you are who you claim to be. We do this through passwords of various strengths, etc. I won't review that because you already know it. A related issue is warranting. If authentication is about proving that you are who you claim to be, warranting is proving that something is what somebody claims it to be. It's about things rather than people. Now, most of warranting is only necessary when you have mass society, when you have relatively anonymous actors interacting with each other. Chances are, if I'm an Ojibwe person 3 centuries ago and I'm giving my neighbor some beads, my reputation is on the line if they turn out to be fake beads made in China by 15-year-old girls, which I guess they actually didn't do 300 years ago, but we'll leave that aside. A little skipping history there. My point here then is that the need for warranting becomes greater as the anonymity and as the bases of usual trust begin to fade thanks to the massiveness of the interactions. Traditionally, we used to do this with a good old king's seal. The king would put his signet ring on a document, and that would warrant that it was actually the document that the king actually approved this. We had signatures for warranting. We had a whole network. We still have them. Nobody really notices them in this country, though they're very important in Europe, of notaries. Notaries basically both authenticate and warrant. They say that this person is who this person claims to be, and this document is what this person claims this document is. It's a verification procedure. A notary is considered a trusted third party who can do this kind of certification. Traditionally under intellectual property law, we have trademarks that are a form of warranting. That is, if you see that little swoosh on something, chances are it's owned by that company in Beaverton, Oregon. Again, probably made by 15-year-old girls in China, but nonetheless is warranted to be the authentic product of Nike Corporation. If you see the golden arches, you know that that is our good friends at the cholesterol factory we call McDonald's. It does not come with a healthcare warranty, unfortunately. So we address these issues of warranting largely through commercial code. We have things like USHTA, the Universal Commercial Code, that prevent fraud. Most of these are state-level laws rather than federal-level laws. Of course, at the federal level, we have anti-counterfeiting statutes and all sorts of things like that. Unfortunately, as we moved to the net, we didn't spend a lot of time thinking about warranting. Hence, on the internet, whether it's the web or even more so through our email systems, we get a lot of very unwarranted stuff. Oftentimes, we simply call this spam. We're all aware of those wonderful Nigerian emails that say, "I am, the cousin of the oil minister, and I have $20 million, and if you give me your bank account number, I'll give you a bunch of money. Thank you. If you do that, you frankly, I won't say deserve to get ripped off, but you got to be pretty dumb." Now, a whole lot of warranting actually traditionally works through reputation. Reputation is a very, very sort of slippery thing. Reputation, we know in an intimate person-to-person basis or in a small group basis, is fairly transparent, fairly easy to know. We know the reputation of our friends, of the people within our housing blocks, things like that, within our classrooms to an extent. Bless you. But at the same time, once we start scaling up, our traditional ways of warranting don't work very well. And so what we end up with is advertising, which emerged roughly about a century ago as a major industry. Advertising implicitly, but not directly by any means, gave a sense of warranting. That is, if we saw an ad for something time and time and time again, even if the goods were bogus. Like, what's that thing, head on, the stuff you go, gets rid of your headache, right? I'm sure it does not work, right? But you run those ads enough and people will say, wow, it must work. No, it doesn't work. In other words, mind share gained by advertising oftentimes morphs into an implicit warranting, which in and of itself is absolutely bogus. It's not warranting anything. All it's getting is mind share. The best example of that kind of warranting in the last few years, I would argue, was our famous firm, Enron. This is the firm that essentially helped buy the presidency for that little guy in the White House back in 2000. They and MBNA Bank were the major funders of his election. Enron, as you might recall, was an energy trading corporation, a commodities future trading corporation, a broadband bandwidth trading corporation. Try trading something that has limitless capacity. Not a very good market, you could imagine. Enron got a lot of warranting by gushy articles in the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, said that this was a great new business model, very innovative businessmen. So their business model, their whole set of business practices were warranted by the press. And indeed, what did we find out early in the year 2001 was that that warranting was based all on glitz, all on shine, all on good connections with journalists, and indeed, it wasn't at all justified. We found out that Enron was a financial empire based on bogus paper and bogus accounting. I mentioned Goebbels here. Goebbels, of course, was a propaganda minister for the Nazis back in the middle of the 20th century. He famously said, and I paraphrase here, if you tell the big lie enough times, it becomes the truth. This is the core, I would argue, of bogus warranting that we get through advertising. My point here, so we get out of these very weak mechanisms for warranting, particularly again on the internet, we really have very few trusted ways to warrant things. You know, we can in some ways use the third-party mechanisms, the PKE sorts of things we talked about with authentication, but in fact, we don't really have particularly good mechanisms for it, and we have, one could argue, it's a postmodern condition that we mistake mind share for honesty, for good goods, as it were. So that pretty much wraps up this piece. You might recall this whole module was on interfaces way back when we started it before vacation. And now we're done. I'll just stick this slide up here. It's on the web, on the class website, so you can just download it. I won't bore you by repeating what we've already said before. So put the big line across your paper. We're now absolutely on track this week. We're going to talk about the info biz. I've wanted to do a whole course on this for quite a while because I find it fascinating stuff. When I first did this course, roughly 2000-2001, I tried to call it, yes, please.
So you're skipping binding information?
Yes, thank you. We are skipping FYI, and this is being recorded so they know it too. FYI, because Maureen Callahan was in your sections and gave you that workshop on finding information, we're skipping that entire module. It gets us up to pace. It was very good work. Maureen is warranted by me, or authenticated by me, to use our contemporary terminology. Very good content. I would urge you, however, to read the stuff there, because there's good material there. A lot of it's how-to stuff, but a lot of it does have to do with trusted sources on the web. How do you find trustable information? There's stuff, for example, on Wikipedia, how trustable is Wikipedia? You might have seen in the Ann Arbor News, for example, the report of a guy who was at EMU last week, I guess it was, who dissed Wikipedia saying, oh, it's a totally unreliable source, etc. Well, yeah, it's a community-made source. Is it more or less reliable than Britannica? Well, that's open to discussion. It's not definitive. No encyclopedia should be definitive as your source of information, but it is a very good starting point. I confess I use Wikipedia quite often to get a hook on things, and then I follow the footnotes, follow the links in Wikipedia, and frankly, those are fairly good links most of the time. It's how I learned about quality control systems, quality control models that I teach in my management course. So we are skipping that content. We're going straight into the business stuff. So this is really not about information economics. How many of you have taken an intro econ course? I would assume the majority have. Only one? Oh, good, two. Okay, I'm surprised. So knowing what you know or what you don't know, I'll be a little more attentive to filling in sort of some of the basic Econ 101 gaps. The point is, though, I'm not really worried about economics per se here. I'm worried more about business. Information content, whether it's whether it's software or content, I'll make that distinction in a moment. Information goods are bought and sold, obviously, and we move to a very different model in how those are paid for, how costs are recovered for putting that stuff out there, that stuff and the services. And so one of my major concerns will be on things like cost recovery, pricing models, how demand is met, how demand is discovered, how demand is generated. There's a standard question that a friend of mine here and I were talking about earlier today. Has the web transformed American business, or is it more of the same, just on a different platform? I think that's a very good question to keep in the back of your mind, and I will continually toss that around throughout this module. Now, the basic foci here will be first on the micro level, how does an enterprise deal with the question of information goods, how do they produce them, price them, et cetera. And the other side is to recognize that, excuse me, with basically cost-free movement of large amounts of highly accurate information that's now possible, knowledge and information can be moved around globally at virtually zero cost, facilitating a global displacement of production, particularly knowledge production. We know, for example, that if one wants cheap radiology work, one can simply send the radiology images to Bangalore, India, and an Indian radiologist can read those films or digital representation of those films for a fraction of the price that one would do it in the US. One can then start asking how many of our knowledge-based jobs are going to go overseas. We've already seen, for example, many of the manufacturing jobs going overseas. The question here is how fully does the internet facilitate the movement of knowledge work outside the boundaries of the US and overseas. But first, a distinction. There are two types of information products that we'll be talking about here. It's information that is content, text, music, movies, etc., the kind of digital content that the major media companies still can't seem to figure out what to do with, can't come up with business models. Again, brings to mind Paul McCartney, 8 years late putting Beatles material on iTunes. The other part of the information market is in information that does. This is software. It performs things. It's tied to a knowledge infrastructure of programmers, skills, and services quite often to deploy it. Buying software, as I'm sure many of you know, or downloading software is only half the story. You have to know how to use it. There has to be a knowledge base and a knowledge ecology to make that stuff work. But before we really get into the gory details here, let's talk about exactly how, I mean, both of them follow the same general economic characteristics, but I'll make that finer grained when we get to it. So we have to ask, how is information as a commodity? And information is a commodity. What do we mean by a commodity, anybody? What's a commodity? Basically, it's anything that can be bought and sold. Karl Marx once, back in the middle of the 19th century, Karl Marx had a great big breakthrough idea when he said, okay, we know that wheat's a commodity. We know that who knows, land is a commodity, but so is capital and labor. There are capital markets. Capital is bought and sold. You basically rent capital when you get a mortgage. And labor itself is a commodity. When I was a historian, one of the major challenges I had conceptually was understanding how long it took European businesses in particular to think of labor as simply something that's bought and sold that has no rights whatsoever beyond, at least in theory, beyond what's owed to them for their labor time. It took, frankly, most European business people well into the middle of the 20th century to wrap their heads around that concept. In the US, we had the notion of labor as a commodity very early on in a system that we called slavery. So once we understand what we mean about information as a commodity that's bought and sold, we can begin to look at the characteristics of that commodity. First of all, on the supply side, that is, in producing information goods, we have what economists call minimal marginal costs. What do we mean by this? What's the cost of the first copy of Vista to come off the production apparatus at Microsoft? If you had to pay the entire cost for developing Vista on one copy, how much would it be? Millions upon millions of dollars. What's the cost of the second copy? $5? The cost of the CDs? I guess they don't deliver documentation with it anymore. It used to be when you bought software, you'd get a CD and 10 pounds worth of manuals. Now we don't even get the manuals. So the production cost of that information good, the dominant operating system in the world, the marginal cost is close to zero. Now, since that's indeed the issue, how do you price this stuff? On the front end, you could say, okay, we're not going to sell many copies of this information product, so we have to recover our costs very quickly, so we'll charge a very high price. That's one basic cost recovery model. That is, front load your cost recovery, price it very high. What's the consequence of this if you do it? If you charge a high price on the front end for your product? Anybody? Come on, folks, wake up. Exactly. How many people would be willing to pay $5,000 a copy for Windows? Right? But if you price it on the basis of product number two coming off the line, you could price it at $5. Big dilemma. And if you price it at $5, basically nobody's going to pirate the good. In the article I posted that I wrote on the music industry, one of the things that I argued is that music, digitally encoded music, costs, as you know, virtually nothing to distribute. That's why we have BitTorrent and LimeWire. The marginal cost of copying music is zero. So how do you price music? The music industry says, well, we have an old pricing model from the pre-digital days. We have an old pricing model which says, oh, we charge $16 for a CD. So they charge us $16, $17 for an information product, the marginal cost of which we know is close to zero. So what's the consequence? They charge that high price, and so the vast majority of people in your demographic group say, we're not going to pay that price, we'll pay marginal cost for it, i.e. zero, and we'll grab it off the net for nothing. My argument in that paper, which I've posted and you'll be reading, my argument in that paper is basically, look, we will have piracy of information goods as long as consumers, and this is a demand-oriented notion of pricing, as long as consumers don't see a value in the full value of the price that's being offered. Let me do a quick test. I'm not going to make any assumptions about who may or may not be downloading music, but how many of you would be willing to pay $16, $17 for a CD? Happily. Don't everybody put up their hands at once, okay? How many of you would be willing to pay $10? Couple. How many of you would absolutely never download music if you could get the equivalent of an album for a couple bucks. Good. Just what I assumed. In other words, this is what we call an elasticity of demand. If we have demand-driven pricing and we can discover what the price preferences of the consumers are, we can theoretically come up with a price of this basically zero marginal cost product that people are willing to pay. Because I would promise, tell me if I'm wrong here, that all of you do think that there is some value to the music, right? And you would be willing to pay, and I'll make a distinction here, how many of you are willing would be willing to pay 10 bucks knowing that $9.50 of it went to the record companies and 50 cents went to the musician? Don't all raise your hands at once. Would you be willing to pay $2 if you knew that $1.75 of that went to the musician that you liked? Exactly my point. In other words, it's not only a question of the price, it's a question of which stakeholders get that money of this marginal, zero marginal cost product. Another characteristic of many digital products, and this is true of content and software both, is that one can modify this stuff endlessly. The cost of modification of the product is relatively cheap. That is, you can take a music file and do certain changes to it. You can do mashups, remixes, etc., endlessly, and the cost of doing that is very, very low. Compare this to the cost of modifying a physical product, a desk, a home, a car, etc., and I think you get my point. Now, if zero marginal cost is the most close to zero marginal cost is the most salient characteristic on the supply side, on the demand side, we have a very weird phenomenon with information products, what economists call non-rival demand satisfaction. Think of it this way. If I have a digital music file on my computer, I can give it to you and still have it. What's my interest in not giving it to you? Am I going to enforce copyright law simply by saying, no, you can't have my music, since it costs me nothing to give it away, and I can build a friendship? Anthropologists will continually tell us that gift giving is a standard kind of social ritual that's used in virtually every society to cement social relationships, okay? And so I can give away music for free because it costs me nothing. What happens if I give away my car? I'm out of a car, right? Very simple kind of equation. So I have a very strong disincentive to giving my car away. I have zero disincentive to giving my music away. Now, that said, another piece on the demand side that I think we have to be very careful to think about is that on the demand side, we often have what's called lock-in, which we often don't have with cars and physical products. If you have a coffee maker and your coffee maker dies, it doesn't matter what you buy to replace your coffee maker. Ditto with cars, ditto with many physical products. But if your computer dies, or if you don't like the word processing software you have, you incur considerable costs to change the product, to change from a Macintosh operating system to a Windows operating system. Chances are you're going to have to throw away a bunch of software because it won't run on Windows, and vice versa, i.e., there are very, very strong lock-ins. Let me give you an example of a project that one of my graduate students is doing. She's studying the software used by a title company. Now, a lot of these specialized software packages, you know, it handles title transfers and tracks documents and that sort of thing. A lot of that market niche emerged in the late 1980s as really clunky, not very good software that ran on only Windows platforms, and it was very proprietary. That is, it was very expensive. They would sell it as a turnkey system. You buy the computer at about a 300% markup, and then you buy the software, which only they know about. And indeed, between about, according to the student of mine, between about 1985 and 1998, basically the entire title industry moved over to these two very proprietary, clunky software systems. They don't work very well. Indeed, they're architected for a whole different set of business practices in the real estate industry that, frankly, are going away. Most notably, and I'll talk about this later when we talk about disintermediation, we're seeing the decline of real estate brokers. That is, why should we be paying real estate brokers 6 to 7% to sell our houses when, indeed, we can just post the information on the web, we can sell our houses ourselves, and we don't have to pay these guys 6 or 7% for virtually no services. Believe me, the last time I sold a house, I actually sold it to somebody I knew, but still had to pay the real estate agents 7% on the sale. Believe me, I was pretty damned irritated. My point here, though, is that there's a reshaping of that industry. The software itself that the title industry is using, it's moving toward a service, single service provider model that does closings on mortgages. The service, as a service provider, that software, the new model that's emerging in real estate, doesn't match the software. So she's looking at it, and I said, well, can they move that data that they have, all of their historic data from the transactions they've had before, can they move it out of the old software? Uh-uh. It's locked in. If they want to recover their data, they have to pay handsomely to this company to buy a software package that allows them to export that software into something else, if they're lucky. And who knows if it's going to export? What is the incentive of that software company to sell them a package that will free them from the software? They are caught in a very, very tight box. To get the software that actually meets their needs, they will probably have to throw away all of their old transactional stuff. And for legal purposes, that's very, very tricky because under the law, a lot of that stuff has to be retained for a number of years. This is really the core of what we mean by lock-in. Again, lock-in also means that if you change your computing environment or your information use environment, you often have to change the infrastructure. You might notice that we're being urged right now to throw away our old CRT TVs, our analog broadcast TVs, 17th of February next year. We will see the end of analog broadcast. We're locked in to analog. Can we move our analog TVs to digital broadcast? Yeah, but we got to buy these little boxes. It's a really kludgy workaround. In other words, to change the delivery mechanism, with a change in the infrastructure, we have a change in the delivery mechanism. Okay, so the question then becomes, how do we cover costs? Getting back to the zero marginal cost problem that I was mentioning at the front end, how do we cover the cost of these information products? In the 20th century, one of the basic ways that we paid for content, certainly, was through advertising. Let me just insert something here, by the way. This is a rhetorical moment, so forgive me. We often hear in politics that it costs an awful lot to run for president or to run for public office. What's the major cost that a campaign has to pay for? What do most campaigns spend the bulk of their money on, aside from Mark Penn and the consultants?
Advertising commercials.
TV advertising. Hey, look at this. The TV stations have broadcasting licenses that the federal government grants them. So then, in order to conduct the business of our democracy, we, the public, have to pay the TV stations in order to run our campaigns. There is a public service requirement on those FCC licenses. We could solve this whole problem simply by saying, hey, legitimate candidates get free TV exposure time. Why not? Yeah.
Some campaigns
Sure, you'd get mudslinging, you'd get exactly the same kind of stuff we have, and it would be for free. And one could say, well, you've just opened up the doors and anybody can diss anybody else. There would have to be some rules. But frankly, you know, we all see trashy advertisements, swift boating stuff. And I think many voters are fairly astute as to the kind of stuff that gets shoveled out there. Just a proposal. It's a little cul-de-sac, but keep it in mind. My point here, though, is that the advertising model seems to have been very, very quickly adopted. Anna, can I borrow your power supply? The advertising model seems to be almost invisibly adopted when we saw the emergence of the commercial internet in the early 1990s. There were some efforts of subscription services. For a while, I personally, subscribed to Salon because I liked it and I was willing to pay for the content. But as you know, the advertising, is this echoing?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. As we know, the advertising supported model has become basically dominant. The expectation of people on the web is that we don't pay for content. Believe me, this has the newspapers in particular quite worried. The New York Times posts its stuff. How many of you read the New York Times or a major newspaper or news feed on the web and don't pay for the paper version? Yeah, you can imagine that this worries the New York Times Corporation. It worries USA Today. It worries Disney Corp that owns ABC. It worries General Electric that owns NBC, etc. I should mention, you know, with an ad-supported model on television, I love it. There was a CNN guy a few years ago who at a national broadcasters conference said, look, television is ad-supported, and if you don't watch the ads, you're stealing the content. Okay, so that mute button turns you into a pirate and into a criminal. By the same token, if indeed the advertising model to support content on the web is advertising-based, right, this is what Google is all about, obviously, then using ad blockers is also a form of piracy. Confessional moment, how many of us use ad blockers? One, two, probably the majority, yeah, yep. I'm in a group of criminals here, folks. We're all stealing that content. Interestingly, Nielsen, that does the click counting and the advertising costs, et cetera, and the various firms that do that, as far as I can tell to this day, still largely ignore the fact that many of us use ad blockers because the ads are blocked at the user side. So when the ad delivery firm, whether it's Google, DoubleClick, AdView, or whatever, they think we're seeing the ads when indeed we're not seeing them. In any case, the advertising model does have counting problems, but at the same time, it's an incredibly powerful way of doing it. Think of it this way. How many of you, when watching a Michigan football game and see that ad for a Dodge Ram pickup, say, I'm going to go out and buy a Dodge Ram pickup? Don't raise your hands all at once. Right? The advertising dollars of Chrysler Corporation trying to sell you a truck are wasted. You're not part of the market. When I see the ads for Boniva or other pharmaceuticals that I don't need, boner medicines or osteoporosis medicines, it's a dead market. They're advertising to somebody who doesn't want it. They're wasting their money to get my attention and pay for my eyeballs. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But remember, Michigan is getting the advertising time kind of free, and it's good PR. Yeah, I mean, University of Michigan during the Michigan games on television has its own ads. We've seen them, the Michigan difference, and you've got the surgeons and professors with shorter hair and more hair lecturing to students and all that stuff. And sure, a lot of people watching it, yeah. But what does it mean? It actually helps us get traction with the taxpayers So they say, we have a world-class university, and maybe we might not want to spend more money on prisons in Michigan than we do on universities, which is, in fact, what we do in Michigan. Yes, indeed, more on prisons and universities. So, you know, there is a broader sort of audience that they're going to. My point here is that the 20th century model of advertising was a mass model. You just blast it out to everybody, and you're paying for a lot of eyeballs, a lot of attention, that frankly isn't in the market. The genius of Google, and it really was genius with AdWords, was to understand that if somebody is looking for information on the internet, you have a piece of information that can tell you, Mr. Google, as it were, what that person might want. So if they key in digital cameras, they might be in the market for a digital camera. There's a high likelihood. So if they put in digital cameras into Google, Google will throw up an ad for digital cameras. Now, if you are Samsung, if you are Sony or one of these digital camera manufacturers, you know that if you're paying Google to deliver a digital camera ad based on a search request for information about digital cameras, aha, you have got a much higher likelihood of a sale. So niche and targeted advertising, and you can slice this thinner and thinner and thinner, is an incredibly smart business breakthrough for the support of content. Indeed, there was a piece in the Times, if I get around to it, I'll post it, but I urge you to just look it up on the New York Times site. It came up yesterday, about the information that search companies like Yahoo, Yahoo is actually much more invidious and insidious than Google is on this, they watch everything we do. Does anybody here use, what's the Google desktop thing? Google search or Google desktop? If you have that, say what?
Google desktop.
There's other Google services that you can install on your machine, and basically it watches everything you do. If you have Google Calendar services, Google Document services, they are harvesting all of this information on you. It kind of makes me nervous, you know, but in fact, I trust Google. They're nice people for now. You know, we thought Microsoft was nice people back in the mid-80s, too. So, you know, times change, opinions change. My point here is that by amassing huge amounts of information on people and using the cookies in your web browser, Google knows who you are, and they can tell their advertisers, look, we can deliver exactly the eyeballs you want, so you're not paying for eyeballs that don't care. Very huge breakthrough. What it also allows, and this is a bit insidious, is incremental adjustments in price. Amazon was accused of this, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes. You know, Amazon knows who I am quite well. They have my purchasing history. Google has my search history. They probably have a pretty good idea of what income bracket I'm in. They have a pretty good idea of what I'm willing to pay for things. And if you are using Google and Amazon, they have a good idea of what you're willing to pay. Frankly, I'm probably willing to pay a little more. I think I probably have a higher income than most undergraduate students. So they could easily say, aha, this is user number XYM96342, aka Bob Frost, and we will charge him a little bit more for this product than we will charge Anna Parisi, for example, because we know that she's a poor graduate student and he's a relatively well-off professor. Little sleazy. There's little evidence that that's going on, but it's certainly a possibility. Another model, again going back to the 20th century, quite different from the advertising supported model, which is dominant, is the commission model. A good example of this is travel sites. If you buy a plane ticket through Orbitz, through Travelocity, one of these, they get a cut of the action. I don't know what their cut is. Some of them don't even get a cut of the action. They simply sell advertising. But the basic model for a lot of the travel sites is a commission model. Now, let's look at this for a moment because it suggests, gives us a beginning of the conversation about what I call disintermediation. Let me put that multisyllabic word up on the board, provided I... chalk. They still have this in the 21st century. Disintermediation. Very important word through this section of the course. What do I mean by getting rid of the middleman? Now, how many of you have bought a plane ticket at a brick and mortar travel agency in the last year? Funny thing about that. They've largely disappeared. Why is that? Exactly. It's much cheaper. The old model for plane tickets, I can't remember what the travel agency markup was. I think it was 5%, that the airlines ate, right? So if you went into Burisma Travel Agency over in Nichols Arcade off of State Street, if you went in there 10, 15 years ago and bought a plane ticket, for a Delta flight, you would pay, say, $250 for the ticket, and of that $250 that you paid Delta, they would bounce back roughly 5% to the travel agency. Now, imagine, what was the service being offered here? You would go there, and Burisma was probably running a terminal that looked at one of two databases that list all of the available flights. There was Sabre and Constellation, I think they were called. Run by the airline industry. Every travel agency had access to one or both of those databases. So you went into the travel agency for a human to key it in, look it up through their terminal, and sell you a ticket. The airlines, circa 1995, said, what in the hell are we paying these travel agencies 5% to look up stuff in a database? We'll just put a web dashboard on it and have Travelocity, Orbitz, etc., build the web interface to those databases and the e-commerce back into it, and we'll get rid of the travel agency. We will disintermediate. And instead of paying, shall we say, I'm not sure of the number, so don't take my word on it, instead of paying 5% commission to the brick and mortar travel agency, they pay maybe 0.5%, maybe 1-2% to Travelocity and Orbitz. Very, very lucrative business model for those e-commerce firms. Is it fundamentally any different from what the travel agencies were doing? Not really. You don't have brick and mortar, but it's still, in the end, looking up to the same, roughly the same databases for the same flight information and handling the transaction electronically in a different way from how it was handled electronically 15 years ago. One can also have commission models. Commission models are very, very handy in cross-marketing arrangements. So, for example, MySpace can cut a deal with, Universal Studios, and for every click to a Universal Studios promotional for a movie, MySpace can get either a payment or a commission from MySpace, i.e. that Rupert Murdoch property. Other pricing strategies. Subscription models, I mentioned this before. These are pretty clunky. Enforcement is very, very hard. You learned a couple weeks ago, thanks to Maureen Callahan, that the University of Michigan pays tens of thousands of dollars a year to subscribe to information content. You can go online and get very, very high value content from the sciences, social sciences, engineering, business, medicine, etc. That is very, very expensive content. We pay millions of dollars a year to have direct access to digital content. And it works. How many of us prefer sitting on our butts in our dorm rooms or our apartments and accessing academic articles rather than schlepping over to the library, going through the stacks, pulling down the paper version and Xeroxing it. Come on, there's huge convenience associated with this. Very nice thing to have. We'll talk about the obscene pricing models that are behind delivery of that digital content. The fact that Kluwer, Elsevier, et cetera, charges out the nose for that digital content, the marginal cost of which, getting back to my earlier point, is virtually zero. Another problem with subscription models is leakage. I have a confession to make. I had a friend briefly in South Florida who was a marine biologist. He worked for the Florida Fish and Game Commission. He was, you know, studied sturgeon. He was a sturgeon specialist. Well, when Jeb Bush, remember Jeb Bush? He used to run state of Florida. He's Shrub's buddy up there, or down there in Florida. Well, when Jeb Bush was running the state, he figured it was far more important to give real estate developers tax breaks than to have digital subscriptions for the Fish and Game Commission. So, bingo, out went the digital subscriptions that the scientists working for the state needed. Well, my friend Dan needed access to that content for one thing that he was doing, so I said, okay, don't tell anybody this, okay? I said, Dan, you're a friend. Let's have an academic cooperation agreement. Here's my password. Just get it via University of Michigan, but please throw it away when you're done. Okay, that's piracy, and I'm sure I violated the use guidelines of the University of Michigan, and I'm sure I'd be hung out to dry for doing it. My point here, though, is that if you have a subscription, if one person buys, all you have to do is share the password. How hard is that? In other words, there's a very real leakage problem unless you have authenticated terminals and only specific terminals with specific Ether card numbers can access it. That's very rarely done. One might ask, what's the price of this stuff? How do you, again, getting back to the earlier question, how do you build a price for some of this subscription stuff? My favorite example, again, you can do it not by a cost-based price, but by a demand-based pricing. Lexis is a huge breakthrough for the legal profession. Under the way we practice law, Anglo-American law, we use precedent. That is, the way we argue, if you're an attorney, the way you argue in front of a court is you say, well, this court decided this, and by analogy, that case is applicable here, so this is what we do. In other words, the basis of doing law under the Anglo-American legal system is to dig up precedents. So legal research is a very, very key part of legal practice. Now, legal research 25 years ago meant largely that if you were a law firm, you hired a first or second year law school student during the summer, and they spent their entire summer pulling volumes off the shelf of these incredibly identical, hundreds of identical volumes to find exactly the right case to use, the right case to use as a precedent. I.e., legal research was incredibly tedious stuff. Now, Mead Data, which owns Lexis and Nexus, they said, hey, we can put together a database of all of these court cases. Not only can we put together a database of the court decisions, we can put in links. We can have links to analyses of them. We can have links to which cases reference which cases. We can have, hey, something like a web of information of linking legal cases to legal cases, each week linking to each other, so that we can facilitate legal research. This is incredibly valuable. Imagine that if you're a law firm, you don't have to buy those law books anymore. You don't have to pay thousands of dollars for low-level legal interns and paralegals to spend hours and hours to dig up the precedents. Instead, you go to Lexis. What do you think this is worth? Not what does it cost marginally, but what's it worth to the law firm? Lots and lots of money. So with this database, Lexis, actually Lexis is now owned by West Publishing, I believe. It moved out of Mead a few years ago. In any case, very, very lucrative. So there are subscription services that are quite valuable. But imagine, hey, you're a small law firm, you just went into business, can you afford the subscription to Lexis, the Lexis database? How can you compete if you're a small law firm? You're going to try and find a way to get access to the Lexis database. Ah, University of Michigan Law School has a subscription. So you can hire a University of Michigan law student as your intern.
They actually can't.
They can't do that anymore?
No.
When did that stop?
I don't know.
How does it work now?
All I know is the students can't get access to cases and documents. I use my mom's government
company. I didn't hear that. Microphone didn't hear that. Right? I mean, because that's piracy of a subscription service, precisely what I was talking about. They don't allow students to use it anymore. Wow. Believe me, they've never allowed non-law faculty to use it. I wanted to use it a few years ago to do a little bit of research, and I said, hey, I'm U of M faculty. Can I use Lexis? Drop dead. Right? Because if they open access, I didn't know that. If they opened it to faculty, the data provider would charge more. I guess they cut students off it. That must be recent. Say what? Really? Wow. I guess the price is, you know, quite high, so they, you know, the cost of allowing students access, that's too bad. That's really too bad. I'm sorry to hear that, because it, you know, getting students trained in using Lexis, frankly, is a key part of professional training at this point. And not being able to, you know, it sounds to me like they just priced themselves out of the market. Either that or there was so much leakage, right? Because indeed the standard practice a few years ago would be that law firms would hire law students so that the law firms could get access via the U of M license to Lexis. So leakage is a very real problem with this. Another model I think is very interesting is a pay-per-use model. We're seeing some of this for TV content. You know, we're not sure what model we're going to see for video content delivery over the internet. There's some suggestion that you can download a movie or a TV show for $1.50, $2, $3, whatever, and it ends up on your hard drive and then self-destructs after a day. In other words, you're paying to use it for a day. It's kind of a rental system. Sounds pretty clunky. How many people think that that's a good model? It's pretty clunky, right? Consumers don't tend to like it. The media companies have, in the past year or two, begun to believe that that might be a desirable way to do it. Every survey they've ever done says that consumers really don't like that model, particularly since we're accustomed to getting much of that content for free on TV, right? We've got TiVos, and we can record it, and we can use BitTorrent to share it illegally, I guess. Is it illegal? I guess it must be illegal to redistribute TV programs via BitTorrent. Must be. I assume it is. I should know that. So we can all say, well, instinctually, pay-per-use is not a particularly attractive model. Yeah?
Why would you share if it's already posted by companies or services?
Because the companies would be charging for it in some instances. See, they don't know either. In some instances, some of the content owners are saying, well, we've already broadcast this episode of Desperate Housewives, which I'm sure all of us are desperate to watch, such high-quality content. Trashy white people in a rich suburb, I guess. I don't know what it is. Never watched it. You know, so they might say, well, we've already broadcast it. We'll rebroadcast it over the net with the ads or with fewer ads, whatever, because they know that they're implicitly competing with digital recorders. Again, they don't know how to price this stuff. So in some instances, they'll say, well, we'll just do it for free. In other instances, they'll say, well, we'll sell it and it'll self-destruct. In other instances, they'll say, we'll just sell it and it won't self-destruct. They're really confused.
But do you believe that free to everyone is the answer to
I don't know what the answer is. I'm going to get to some of that later on in this discussion. I think one of the answers is blow up your TV and read something, but I won't go that far. But what, you know, that said, one of the things that, as we know, the content industry has discovered is that television watching, for example, if we're talking about video content, television watching has gone down considerably because it turns out that people are spending more time in wonderful places like MySpace instead of wonderful places like ABC watching trashy suburban housewives. Excuse my cultural commentary, but you know, it comes with a product. So as dumb as this sounds, oh, and there is one problem with pay-per-use, and that is if you're buying small snippets of information, say you want to download an article from the New York Times or from the Wall Street Journal, you know, they might want to charge you 25 cents for that content. How many of us would be willing to pay 25% for a high-quality download content article from the Times? Yeah, you know, if it's good, if it's clean, you don't have to fart around with formatting and everything. Comes out very nice. Problem is, how do you do a 25-cent transaction on the web? Well, if you do it with MasterCharge or Visa, you're going to pay a minimum of, I think, 30, 40 cents for the transaction itself, for a 25-cent transaction. Doesn't make much sense. It's what we call the micropayments problem. This is why we have a firm such as PayPal that emerged to solve, to an extent, the micropayments problem. What does PayPal do but aggregate micropayments and then make single payments of aggregated payments to the credit card companies so they the fixed overhead per transaction gets reduced. But that said, micropayments problems notwithstanding, consumer problems notwithstanding, we might actually imagine a good model for software in pay-per-use. Think of Photoshop. How many of you have used Photoshop? Probably the majority of us. Yeah. How many of you would be willing to pay $300 for as much as you've used Photoshop? Just what I thought. How many of you have used Photoshop more than 20 hours in any one year? Maybe, right. So are you going to pay $300? I don't know what it costs. We have a site license, so I'm not particular. What does it cost full retail? Anybody know? Anna, do you know? Yeah. $800. Okay, the full creative suite is like $1,500. Now, how many of us are going to pay $1,500 for the Adobe Creative Suite, assuming no student discount? Doesn't happen. Now, think of it. So what do? If we want to use Photoshop, confessional moment, how many of you have pirated Photoshop or used a pirated copy? Right, exactly. Because the alternative to Adobe, the alternative that Adobe product users have is either pay the incredibly high price for that software or pirate it. Let me argue here that maybe a credible model would be that you rent Photoshop, you get a time-limited enabling license that comes over the web, you pay for it. How many of you would be willing to pay $1 an hour, $2 an hour to use Photoshop? Nobody. Okay, a couple. That, I think, is a much more credible model. In other words, one can imagine a pay-per-use model for software, but unfortunately, I don't see this happening much. Yeah. $650 for the basic model. It's not like Vista where you have five different models and you're not sure what comes with it. Okay. $650. How many of us are going to pay $650 to use Photoshop for a couple hours? I don't think so. In other words, this is underlining one of my fundamental arguments here, and that is the information content and software providers really still have not fully figured out credible business models to deliver this stuff. pay per use. Maybe that works in some environments. Maybe it doesn't. Subscriptions, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There are many, many dilemmas as to what works and what doesn't. And we still haven't seen much of a convergence of business models and how this stuff is actually going to happen. Again, the music industry, I think, is symbolic of the whole mess. The record companies haven't wrapped their heads around what the age of digital distribution, competing with free music as they do, should look like. But I think there's a deeper problem here. Yeah. Exactly. The question was, shouldn't we do disintermediation for the record companies? That's exactly what I argue in my first Monday article that I published last year. That is, we don't need the record companies. We can build much better peer-to-peer, or shall we say, grassroots systems to distribute music. What's the music industry there for? Tell me, what does the music industry actually do? Identifies music and identifies consumers and connects musicians with consumers, right? And delivers the content between the two. They charge a very high price to do this. We pay many, if you buy music, you pay many, many times more to the record company than what you pay to the musician, simply to connect you to the musician. So disintermediation can be done. And it can be done, and I think, in a very intelligent way, in which I think we can be confident, as I surveyed you, that you're willing to pay for music. You are willing to pay the musicians whose music you like. How many people aren't willing to pay the musicians they like? Like, we don't have a problem with this, right? So if we can get our payments to the people who are actually producing the content, we don't have a problem anymore. Disintermediation, I think, is the future for a lot of content delivery. The question is, and this gets also to the music industry question, the music industry problem, the question is, what's actually being sold? If you look at the music industry, a lot of what they're spending money on is promotion and advertising. You know, I'm not in the same media markets you are, and I rarely read the Daily. But the record companies spend an awful lot of money telling you how much you want to buy that next Britney Spears album. They don't, you guys don't buy that stuff, but they still try and sell it to you, right? Again, they don't know who their market is. They're blasting it at you. You're looking at this stuff and say, who wants to watch that Texas trash play music? We won't go there. Again, cultural commentary comes for free. My point here is that the music industry spends more money trying to get your eyeballs and your attention than they actually do producing the music itself. It gives us an insight into what Richard Lanham calls the distinction between stuff and fluff. I disagree with his argument in his book, The Information Economy. He argues that, well, we're really into an age now, and this is the question I posed at the beginning of the lecture. He argues that, well, we've largely moved into an era where stuff really doesn't matter. What really matters is attention. Kind of puts us into celebrity culture stuff, right? You know, what really matters is your 15 minutes of fame, or is it 15 minutes or seconds? When you're misquoting Andy Warhol, you know that you're really getting a little bit lame. My point here is that what's being sold are eyeballs. Because indeed, and Lanham makes a very important point, he overstretches it, but in fact, we have a huge oversupply of information. I have thousands and thousands of albums that I don't have the time to listen to. So what's really important is your attention. Your attention is the commodity that's in shortest supply. This is why there is such a thing called advertising. They want to buy your eyeballs. They want to buy your attention. Once they get your attention, then they can sell the product. My point here then, and think of this very carefully, my point here is that if information is the most valuable commodity, why the hell aren't we getting paid for it? Why the hell, when we see advertisements that pollute our visual terrain, they are stealing something from us. They are stealing the most valuable thing we have to offer. Called attention. When you see a billboard, I'm flipping the CNN guy's line around. When you see a billboard that you don't want to see, for that strip club between here and the airport, or for Weber's restaurant where you've got to be easily over 90 years old to eat the food, when you see these billboards, they're stealing your attention. That is theft. Every bit as much, if the CNN guy wants to say watching TV and using the mute button is theft, a billboard stealing your attention is equally theft. There has to be a symmetry if we're talking about an information economy. But there is some old stuff that still goes on here. If we look at e-commerce, particularly traditional, I love to use the word traditional e-commerce. I never thought we'd be here. But e-commerce as it was invented in the 90s and still largely as it's practiced, it's surprising how little has changed. They're still buying eyeballs. They're still trying to use the old business models. And for the most part, if you look at the back end of how e-commerce works, frankly, all they've done is replace brick and mortar and checkout clerks with visual displays of the stuff instead of shelf displays, and a point and click and keyboard interface instead of a checkout clerk. It's basically the same. We have a reading this week about the 800 number revolution. How many of you have ever, you've probably heard of Land's End. If you listen to Prairie Home Companion, it's sponsored by Land's End in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Land's End got its start in the 1980s, long before the web. How did they do it? They said, okay, we'll make sort of L.L. Bean kind of clothes and J. Crew kind of clothes, kind of preppy looking stuff, certainly not cool, sort of the suburban crowd, the 30-something suburban crowd. They figured that was a very good niche, and they sold their goods, not through storefronts, but by sending out catalogs. I used to get Land End catalogs at least twice a week. I was in their desired zip code, so I got endless numbers of L.L. Bean catalogs, of Land's End catalogs, of all of this manner of stuff, and, you know, I'd look through them, gosh, do I really want another rugby shirt, another polo shirt? I don't think so. How about these elastic waist pants for middle-aged guys? I don't think so, at least not in those years. My point here is that the back end, the fulfillment end of Land's End in 1985 is absolutely no different from your web retailers today for the most part. They still have inventory. They still have just-in-time supply management systems. They still have very sophisticated sourcing arrangements. Now they reach to Asia, all the way through the job shops. They can get contract manufacturers to make plastic and chromium and electronic things if they're in that business, i.e. the supply chains reach further. They can find cheaper goods, different goods, more niche marketed goods. But in the end, it's the same infrastructure from 1985. Instead of having a printed catalog, they have a web-based catalog. Instead of having an 800 number with a bunch of operators standing by, they have a web interface where they don't even have to hire operators to stand by and wait for your call. What this involves, though, and think of it again from the 800 number retailing revolution, it's just changing the front end of it. But there's a whole lot more that can go on here. That is, one can informate, a very ugly word. Let me put it up on the board. Well, it's already up on the slide. One can informate this. I hate the word. My colleagues tell me, Bob, this is really an ugly word. Don't use it. It's embarrassing. I still use it anyway. What do I mean by informating? Informating, at the very minimum, means that you take a traditional or an existing business process and move it to a well-considered, electronically-based, IT-based platform. Land's End did that. Worked very, very well. Amazon is based on informated mass retailing. While I'm at it, let's see, I have 4 minutes left. While I'm at it, let me suggest the kicker in what informating actually managed to do. I'm going to skip a little bit ahead. The retail model of the 20th century was based on our good old-fashioned lack of chalk. No, it was based on our good old-fashioned normal curve, right? We've all seen the normal curve, right? And if you go to any store, they follow what's called the Bradford distribution, the Pareto distribution, whatever, that 80% of the people will want 20% of the product, so 20% of what's on offer. So that's what you put on your shelves. You go to Kroger, you go to Walmart, heaven forbid you go to Sears and Roebuck, the absolute pinnacle of classic mass 20th century retail, and that's the model. So if you go to Walmart and look for music, you'll find all of the Toby Keith and all of the Hannah Montana and all of the Britney Spears that you can ever digest without barfing, which is probably not very much. But if you want to find Zap Mama, you want to find Johnny Clegg, you want to find Leo Kottke, it's not going to be there. It's out on the tail. Because, in fact, the limited commodity in retail is shelf space. Why the hell is Walmart, if they're even smart enough, well, they're smart, very smart on IT, they're really dumb and really bad in their taste. Ooh, Walmart fashion. I won't go there, it's way too easy. My point here is that Walmart isn't going to do the tails because the cost of handling the inventory for the tails, for the obscure music, for the obscure clothes, for the niche markets ain't there. What Amazon discovered, and they were one of the first to do it, is to realize, Netflix also I should mention, is to realize, well, okay, there's a huge mid-market here. But there's an untapped market out on the tails. Let me close in the last minute and a half on Netflix. Do we have any Netflix people here? One, two, three. I love Netflix. Netflix business model is very interesting. If you want to buy, if you want to rent Saw 4, that wonderful masterpiece of Hollywood artistry, if you want to rent Saw 4 on the day it comes out, don't go to Netflix. Go to Blockbuster, because they've bought thousands nationwide, millions of copies of Saw 4 to meet this peak of the normal curve demand, which will disappear in 3 weeks. But if you want to wait 3 weeks and your taste is sufficiently bad, you can get Saw on Netflix. Interestingly, Saw 4, interestingly, Netflix will pay roughly 25% of what they would have paid by buying it 3 to 4 weeks after it comes out. They buy it much cheaper. Yeah. Absolutely. Netflix business model is a really clunky one, right? Mailing CDs through the mail. When I saw it, I was thinking, this is digital distribution. What are we using the postal system for? Absolutely, point well taken. But their business market says, aha, there's an audience out there for Louis Buñuel's Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. There's a market out there for watching old Martin Scorsese films that you're not going to find at Blockbuster. Blockbuster has all of this stuff. Netflix has the tail. And believe me, I am a dedicated Netflix person, because if I want to find that obscure French film from 1959 that has the Miles Davis musical score in the background, Netflix will have it. They've got me nailed in. They have found a market on the tail, and it's very lucrative. Amazon has done the same thing. We'll talk more about this on Thursday. Thanks very much. You've been very patient.